Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. America is known the world over for its fascination with big cars. We did flirt with smaller compact vehicles, but that didn't last long, and now big cars, big trucks, big SUVs are back and getting bigger. Last year, trucks and SUVs made up 80% of all new car sales. 80%. That's up from just 52% in 2011. Consumers say they feel safer in these vehicles. They like riding high above the road, but in truth, as the weight of your car increases, your chances of surviving do go up, but the risk of killing others also increases. Data tells us that collisions with a truck or SUV have a 30% higher fatality rate than collisions with a smaller sedan. Well, that is certainly the case here in Mecklenburg County, where trucks and SUVs outsell everything else, while the number of traffic fatalities has risen. According to Ryan Pitkin at QC Nerve, where they keep a log of all of this, there have been 73 traffic fatalities here just this year. So what's behind our fascination with bigger and bigger cars and trucks? How do their ever-increasing numbers affect our roads, our parking lots, city planning, our safety, and our climate? Let's find out. Seth Lajeunesse is Senior Research Associate at the UNC Highway Safety Research Center. He's here along with Zach Ward, consultant at the automotive market research firm J.D. Power & Associates. And Tesho Akindele is Development Analyst at Camp North End. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Thanks for having us, Mike.
You're very welcome. Zach, let me start with you from J.D. Power, because J.D. Power is involved in lots of things having to do with cars, rating cars, helping people buy and sell cars, which I didn't know till yesterday when I went on your website. That's new. To me, that's new. It's a kind of an Edmunds thing, but J.D. Powers is involved in it, too. What does your research show you about our fascination with bigger vehicles? Do we understand why consumers have been gravitating increasingly toward these vehicles?
Mike, that's a great question. And I wouldn't say it's any monolithic factor. There's no one overarching reason that customers have immigrated toward larger vehicles. Many reasons have been given, whether it's the higher ride height, the confidence that confers to the customer, the feeling of safety, at least as far as perception goes, as you touched on before. But as you've already alluded to, the trend is clear. Since the global financial crisis and the outcome of it, customers increasingly have migrated towards larger vehicles. And much of this, as I'm sure we're going to touch on later in the show, is driven by manufacturers kind of emphasizing these vehicles as well.
We are going to touch on that, but I also want to find out when it started, why it started, because we did, I guess, maybe beginning with the gasoline crisis, which was in the Carter administration a long time ago. But during that, and also about that same time, smaller cars from Asia began to make their way across the Pacific Ocean to us, and we did flirt with smaller cars. Then suddenly, the trend reversed. When did it start? Why did it start? What was the impetus for it? Where was it coming from?
Yeah, of course. So the oil embargo in the 1970s was kind of the genesis for the founding of corporate average fuel economy, or CAFE, as it's known in the industry. And with this, for the first time, and not for greenhouse gas emission reasons, purely for conserving energy for our stores of gasoline, we set these measures in place where there were increasingly stringent targets that manufacturers need to hit across their entire portfolio of vehicles as far as fuel economy was concerned. And you saw customers start to move towards more fuel efficient vehicles that were already on offer. Basically, Asian OEMs had these vehicles on tap and were able to meet the market demand as it came about. They just happened to be there at the right time. And increasingly, this trend becomes evident. But customers start to move towards sport utility vehicles towards the early aughts. And these are actually an increasingly popular segment of the industry. And a trend much like what we were seeing now was beginning. However, the global financial crisis completely inverts that, and people flock back with the rise of gas prices to these smaller, more fuel-efficient vehicles. And it's only become, you know, the trend that once was is happening once more with customers moving towards larger vehicles.
As I think you mentioned, Zach, there are myriad reasons why people gravitate toward these cars. Yeah. There are as many reasons as there are people, I suppose. There have always been large families, and some people get these because they have a large family and a dog, and they carry the soccer team all over town to practice and things like that. But others don't. The family size is 2.0. I mean, they get the mother, father, child, maybe two children and a dog. And for years, they survived in a sedan, even a compact sedan or a station wagon. Now, and I guess people are weekend warriors that go to Lowe's and Home Depot and have to, or Costco, and have to bring home a lot of stuff, all of which probably, most of which can fit in a sedan or a station wagon. But they don't even make station wagons anymore. I guess the question is, why has this changed? Because people also buy trucks, pickup trucks, four-seater pickup trucks now, as their family car. Is that being pushed on them? Is it a style thing? Is it a status symbol? What is this about?
Certainly that's a factor within it. As I mentioned before, the SUV is just perceived as a safer vehicle, one that, you know, has a more solid build type, right? But I think something that I've omitted previously with this new wave of customers trending toward larger vehicles is the genesis of the crossover utility vehicle. So historically, SUVs were built on ladder frames. They were basically trucks with their beds covered and turned into a passenger compartment. But especially after the global financial crisis, you see this movement towards crossover utility vehicles, which are unibody or monocoque. And this mitigates much of the dissuading factors that existed previously. Their fuel economy is very comparable to that of a passenger sedan. You know, the cost is only marginally greater, but you get these additional benefits of this ride height, this perceived safety, potentially the status that is conferred. And you see that customers are more satisfied with these vehicles as well. It's almost become taboo to be in a minivan or a station wagon, as those are associated with their youth, right?
It's your father's car.
The SUV has become the predominant body style on the road today. So, you know, you see everybody kind of moving towards this new norm, right?
I think that Americans don't realize how manipulated they are by marketing and advertising. It's so ubiquitous that it is subliminal and it washes over us, and we think it's our idea, but it probably isn't our idea. And I'm just curious, Zach, before I move on to our other guests here for a second or two, how much of this is due to manufacturers and dealers? In other words, if I walk into a dealership to buy a car with my spouse and my 2.5 children and allude to the fact that I have a Labrador Retriever back at home, are they going to automatically steer me away from a sedan toward an SUV? Is that going to be their modus operandi?
I don't think it's anything quite like that. Salespeople on the floor are going to be motivated to make a sale as quickly as possible. And if a consumer comes in looking for a sedan, more than likely that's going to be the easiest sale that you could make. However, on the manufacturer side, there do exist many incentives that may push the manufacturer towards creating more SUVs to meet the market, right? And I think some of our other panelists here might get into the reasons that manufacturers have been kind of pushed in that direction, whether it's permissiveness within this CAFE framework or greater safety regulation, et cetera. So the absolute number of SUVs on offer within the manufacturer's portfolio has grown over time, which has kind of naturally steered consumers in that direction as well.
Seth Lajeunesse is also with us this morning. He's senior research associate at the UNC Highway Safety Research Center. These larger vehicles, you know, we heard about high gas prices during the recent campaign, but they're not high in comparison to what they have been historically. They're relatively low, and that means you can afford to drive these bigger cars because they do use more gas. They are heavier. Does that weight have any measurable impact, Seth, on our roadways, either in terms of wear and tear on the pavement or by taking up more space on the road, which makes traffic jams longer because these cars are bigger, there's less room for them on the road? What impact do they have on all of that?
Yeah, Mike, you're totally right. The weight of it does matter in a lot of different ways. Yeah, so like you referenced the wear and tear on the road. Certainly that is the case. So more maintenance dollars devoted to repaving the asphalt and such. There's also structures like parking garages. These vehicles are heavier, and when you have a collection of them in a parking garage, if it's an older one and under different standards, we're very concerned about the structural integrity of some of these facilities.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. I mean, don't hear much about the collapses of parking decks, but a lot of these parking decks were built at a time when these big trucks, SUVs are trucks, let's be honest. That's how the government looks at them anyway. But these big SUVs, these big honking trucks that don't really fit into the parking spaces that were designed, are much heavier than the cars that these parking decks that went up in the 50s and 60s and 70s were designed to hold. How big a concern is that really for structural engineers?
You know, that's a great question. You'd have to ask structural engineers. I'm not one, I have to admit. I will say though, there are some serious concerns, especially as you referenced, Mike, earlier in a conversation we had around electric vehicles. Well, if you have an electric SUV, these are quite substantially heavier than an internal combustion engine SUV on average. The same make and model, right? But if it's an EV model, it's going to be heavier. If you have a collection of these and these diffuse through the market and you have market penetration of these and they constitute a higher proportion of the vehicles out there, and you have a very popular parking deck, maybe it's in a really busy commercial area, you can foresee problems, especially if that deck was built to standards like you were referencing from decades earlier when the model vehicle was a different model entirely. I think it is going to be increasingly a concern, and there'll probably have to be some reinforcement of older facilities if we want to be proactive about this.
Wow. Tesho, I'm not sure this is your area of expertise, but I know that you're in charge of development at Camp North End. And these are things that I guess developers think about when they build new structures or rehab older structures. How big a concern is this?
I guess, you know, if you start with just parking garages themselves, you know, you have kind of minimum sizes that you need for each parking space. So if you build a deck that's six stories and 120 feet on each side, you can fit so many spaces. But let's say you imagine a world where, because not only are people buying more SUVs, but these SUVs are becoming bigger over time, like each new model is becoming bigger. So it's foreseeable that the requirements for parking spaces are going to get bigger if this trend continues, which means you'll be able to fit less cars in the same amount of space. So you need to build bigger structures, which means more space dedicated to cars, less space dedicated to people. And, you know, especially in our urban areas, this kind of becomes a real problem.
And this is just my own observation, and certainly it's anecdotal, but as parking lots that I've noticed have been repaved and restriped for parking spaces, it looks like those spaces are smaller, that they're narrower, that they're trying to fit more cars in the same amount of space over time. And yet this is happening at the same time the cars are getting bigger. Is that my imagination?
It might be the spaces are smaller, but I think it's more likely the cars are bigger, so they're kind of squeezing out to the sides a little more than they used to.
Okay, we're going to continue this exploration of our love affair, not just with big cars, just in cars in general, because America loves cars. But the big cars in particular we'll talk about as we go through the program. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. www.charlottetalks.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about big cars and our fascination with them. Seth Lajeunesse is with us. He's a senior research associate with the UNC Highway Safety Research Center. Zach Ward is a consultant with J.D. Power and Associates. And Tesho Akindele is development analyst for Camp North End. Zach, on every new car that you buy, there's a window sticker. And on that window sticker is the EPA mileage estimate, miles per gallon estimate on it. Larger vehicles are generally less fuel efficient than smaller cars. And according to Yahoo News, they are usually driven by more conservative individuals who may have fewer concerns about environmental damage caused by emissions or the use of gasoline. Are a vehicle's miles per gallon rankings and or their emissions numbers that Consumer Reports and others, maybe even J.D. Power's reports on, are they a point of concern for prospective buyers today, or do they just ignore that? They want the car.
I wouldn't say that it's necessarily ignored by potential prospective buyer, but if we were to look at the grand scheme of things, the weight of that purchase criteria would be very low in the consumer's mind. Very few consumers are list that as one of their top purchase criteria. It could be a dividing line between two otherwise similar vehicles. However, it very rarely is listed as a top of mind consideration for a consumer, the fuel economy of a vehicle.
Policy over time builds up and maybe have conflicting goals, and sometimes the goals conflict with other things that have not been turned into policy. Tesho, this is not just consumer demand driving these vehicles. It's also the fact that I think there is a specter of larger profits by manufacturers and dealers if they get you into a larger vehicles. And even as city and highway planners work toward reducing traffic and finding alternative ways to transport people and warn that we cannot build enough roads to build our way out of congestion, at the same time, there are these regulatory loopholes that favor trucks that have helped more consumers move to these vehicles, including new fuel-efficient standards that subject larger vehicles to fewer, lesser regulations. Smaller cars have far greater goals to meet. Why? Why aren't we all on the same page, Tesho?
Yeah, you have lobbyists obviously advocating for their own interests. You can probably make more profit on a bigger car, on a more expensive SUV or a truck. But, you know, there are things that we can do to push back on this. You know, I think one simple example would be every year in North Carolina, you have to register your car. So like Seth was saying, bigger cars put more of a burden on our roads, on our parking garages. It probably makes sense that the registration fees for a larger car should be more than the registration fees for a smaller car. So I think that's kind of one of a common sense example of something we can do to change the regulatory framework. And then, you know, as those costs get passed along to the consumer, people will have to weigh their options. Right now, you know, the ripple effects of driving a larger car are not really priced in to the vehicle itself or priced into the ongoing maintenance. So if you're out here causing more, you know, wear and tear on the road, it makes sense that you should have to pay for that. Some people would gladly pay for that, and others might, you know, rethink their decision on purchasing a sedan versus a large truck.
As we talk about this, we may be giving the impression that some of us feel that big cars are a bad thing. And I don't think that's true. I don't think we do feel that way. And that's certainly not what this conversation is meant to be. But is there a downside, or does it balance itself out, these big cars? Is it that we are simply not, we haven't planned and we are not equipped to deal with a plethora of these cars, to the fact that they have eclipsed everything else? Is that really the problem here, Tesho?
I mean, I think generally it's just less efficient. Like you said, you know, the city of Charlotte, for example, started as a small city back in the day. And you initially had the suburban dream where you could live 5 or 10 minutes from the city and drive whatever vehicle you wanted straight into the city. But as we get more and more people here, people are living 30, 40, 50 minutes away from the city. You can even see the literal size of the city of Charlotte is now, whatever, 315 square miles, where it used to be 50 square miles. So the city's getting much larger, and it's just not really practical for everybody to get into the city and get around the city in large single occupancy vehicles. So I don't think they're necessarily bad, but we need to think as a society, what is the most efficient way to give everybody's quality of life up high? And I think, reframing the incentives, like I said, with registration fees or making public transportation better, giving people different options to say, okay, maybe a big SUV is my best way to come to work and that's what I'll do, or maybe it's riding the blue line and that's what I'll do. But just giving people kind of an accurate choice to make instead of kind of shifting the incentives towards, right now, they're kind of shifted towards SUVs and big trucks. And so I think you're seeing distorted results from that.
And there seems to be a reluctance or at least resistance to supplying alternative forms of transportation. The city has been working hard to do it, but we need money for that. And that money is scarce at the federal level and maybe even more so at the state level, where they really don't understand Charlotte, because the legislature comes from more rural areas. And there seems to be resistance to building out a transit system. And if you don't build it out, you got to use your car in a city like Charlotte, because that was designed for cars. Another thing that is working to move consumers into these larger vehicles is a lack of choice. A lot of manufacturers, I think Ford among them, have simply stopped making sedans. I think the only sedan Ford makes now is the Mustang. And that means more bloated vehicles on the road. They're heavier, they require more energy to move, they erode their tires more quickly, they wear more heavily on roadways. That increases highway maintenance expenses, Seth, and on and on and on. We also have to have frozen the federal gas tax. It was set, I think, at 18.4 cents per gallon in 1993 and has not moved since. That money supports roads and transit. So why have we created policies that encourage larger vehicles, Seth, without raising the gas tax for infrastructure purposes?
Mike, that's a great question. It's actually something that we discuss in the transportation research world. We've been discussing that for decades now. I think it's for the usual suspects. There's basically organized lobbying to not touch that. Certainly, the oil industry doesn't have much interest in seeing that increase, the marginal gas tax. Most consumers probably wouldn't be too pleased with paying more for gas. In fact, whenever we hear news about gas prices, it's usually that they're too high or there's some search for a way to maybe produce more gas domestically to reduce costs, right? I think that's, but essentially, it's sort of, there's sort of a dependency in a lot of households, I think, on vehicle travel. A lot of people, we've surveyed this in North Carolina, a lot of people do actually want meaningful choice in how they get around. They want to be able to take transit if it's available and actually convenient to them. They'd love to be able to walk to a coffee shop, but they have to cross the six-lane highway to do that. It doesn't feel safe. So the environment in which a lot of people are living in is just simply not conducive to any other form. If we're totally dependent on driving, then anything we can do to sort of keep the cost as low as possible is probably going to be attractive. So I think we just live in a system now that really does privilege driving over all else and actively suppresses a lot of other options.
Another thing driving people toward these larger cars, no pun intended, Tesho, is the fact that we don't have neighborhood schools, particularly in this city, because of various factors. It's just almost impossible to have them. And parents have resorted to driving their kids to school, and maybe the next door neighbor's kids or some other kids in the neighborhood, so they gravitate toward these bigger vehicles. You also have mentioned that it's very expensive, and zoning laws prohibit, in some cases, the opening of daycare centers in urban areas. And so these places where parents have to take their kids when they go to work are generally on the outskirts. So they have to drive a bunch of kids out and come back to work. Is that a topic of conversation among planners? Clearly, you're aware of it, are they?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think so. There's two things going on here. One is the neighborhood schools, and I'm from Colorado, where almost everybody went to a public school there. It was just normal. You went to your neighborhood school. I walked to elementary school, middle school, high school, as did a lot of my classmates. Here in Charlotte, there's more of a culture of magnet schools and private schools. So people are going to schools that are a little bit further away from their houses, which means that parents kind of have to spend more time take like maybe one of your children goes to a school 15 minutes this way, one goes 15 minutes the other way. You're spending more of your time taking your kids around to different schools. So I think when somebody goes to purchase a car, if you know you're going to be spending an hour and a half a day, dragging your kids around. I got two kids too. Like if you're dragging your kids around for an hour and a half a day, you want to make sure you're comfortable and they're comfortable. It makes sense. If we could get back to more of a model where more kids are able to walk, bike, take the bus to school, I think you might see some shifting choices being made there. And then another thing is, yeah, just schools or daycares in urban areas. Like if you looked at the center of Charlotte, 30 square mile circle, I'm pretty sure there's zero high schools within that boundary, which is pretty crazy. Like that should be kind of the most populated area of our city. We should be attracting families to want to move and stay in the city. But if there's no high schools there, how are they going to do that? It's also, like you mentioned, it's difficult to build daycares in the city because there's regulations about how much outdoor space you need, how much space you need inside the classroom. And so maybe we need to be looking at flexible solutions like can daycares count, public parks as their outdoor space and have kind of a safe path to the public parks instead of having to have their own football field sized outdoor fenced in area in the city. It's impractical. Nobody was going to be able to afford that. So the result, again, is just daycares have to move outside of the city, which means families have to move outside of the city. People are driving more. And then at that point, it kind of does make sense that your preference is to drive a larger, maybe more comfortable vehicle because you'll spend more time driving.
We're going to talk about the perception of safety in these vehicles in some depth in a second. But according to Vox, federal, and I never thought about this until I read this yesterday, but federal safety standards for vehicles touch on everything in the car, from the power windows to the seat belts to the airbags. They do these crash tests on these vehicles to make sure that the occupants will be as safe as they can humanly be in a horrible crash. But there is nothing in the regulations that govern a car's design with an eye toward protecting people outside the car, like pedestrians or bicyclists or even other vehicles, smaller vehicles. Tesho, is that because it's impossible to do that, or is there some other factor at work?
It's not impossible. They've been considering those factors in Europe, for example, for a long time. And there is actually some legislation kind of getting talked about right now that will have SUV manufacturers think about how the design of their car impacts pedestrians. For example, like having a high front end of your car means if you impact with a pedestrian, you're more likely to hit their head, which is more likely to cause serious damage to the pedestrian or death. So this is being talked about now, and it has been implemented in other countries. So I expect that this is something that's a long time coming, and hopefully will be a change made.
Zach, I mean, I can't remember the last time I drove a car that I could see the front end out of the windshield. I mean, everything drops off at the edge of the windshield in most of the cars that I've driven recently. And I saw yesterday an illustration of somebody in a large, kind of oversized pickup truck. They cannot see a 4-foot-tall child in front of their car because the hood extends so far out and is so high that they simply can't see them. That's a big blind spot. Is that something that is being effectively addressed by modern technology?
Yeah, that's a great question, Mike. Certainly since, I would say, midway through the 2010s, potentially even up to 2020, we've seen a proliferation of advanced driver's assistance features in automakers' lineups. So these include things like blind spot warning, lane keep assist, but significantly front collision warning, rear cross traffic alert, pedestrian warnings, side door warnings to let you know not to open a door where you could clip a bicyclist. These features are becoming increasingly equipped on vehicles as standard. Previously, they were only available and were significantly more expensive, but as economies of scale have been achieved and they proliferate through manufacturers' lineups, not only are they equipped on their most premium, largest offerings, but also kind of more mainstream offerings as well, which is good to see to make up for the deficits that you've alluded to.
How long does it take on average for new technology like that to become the dominant force in the world of cars? In other words, if you have a 19, well, if you have a 2015 large truck, you probably don't have that technology. How long will that vehicle be on the road before it's replaced by a vehicle where these are all standard features?
It's a great question. I believe the statistic at the present moment is 13 to 14 years old is the average registered vehicle on the road today. So, you know, it, return to market for consumers is a little bit more frequent than that. Obviously, there's quite a large used market. So people are purchasing, you know, consumers are purchasing used vehicles, which inflates that number a bit. But yeah, that vehicle will exist, maybe not for the first owner, but a subsequent owner for quite some time, on average about 14 years.
Are these technologies that you talked about, this cross-traffic warnings and the fact that maybe your car will stop without you making it stop if it knows it's going to hit somebody in the front end, are these mandated now as standard features by the government? Are they seen by automobile manufacturers and dealers as key selling points? Do consumers view them that way?
Yeah, so all the features that you just alluded to are not currently required by the government. However, both government institutions such as the National Highway Traffic and Safety Administration, as well as a quasi-governmental consortium of insurers, the Insurance Institute of Highway Safety, incorporate statistics or safety criteria surrounding these advanced driver's assistance features into their safety ratings for vehicles that consumers can see. Additionally, consumers are increasingly demanding these safety features in their vehicles. And we see a preference towards vehicles that have these and these features. And as I mentioned, many of these are becoming standard on mainstream vehicles, kind of entry-level classes like compact SUV and compact sedans increasingly have these features equipped as standard. But to answer your question, no, they're not required by the government at this point in time. However, that's not to say that couldn't be the case in the future. For example, rear view cameras were required from model year 2017 onward on all vehicles sold in the United States. Whereas I think the first vehicle to offer that was an Acura in the 1990s that offered it as at significant extra cost as a standalone option. So it's very interesting to see how quickly we've progressed. I would say safety is one of the fastest changing dynamics or paradigms in the industry at the moment, especially with autonomous driving and the movement towards that.
It's also the fact that technology has rapidly made these things less expensive to do. I mean, we're all carrying around cameras in our pockets now, and that same technology is at use in these backup cameras and all the cameras that monitor your movement of your vehicle if you have semi-self-autonomous driving in some of these cars. When we come back, I want to talk about how drivers in these large cars view themselves and how it affects their driving habits, Seth, and also America's love affair with cars. No question that we've had one ever since the Model T, I think. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about big cars, our fascination with them, the fact that there are more of them on the road now, SUVs and pickup trucks that are large than any other automobile that is currently being sold. And that's partly due because some manufacturers don't even think about sedans anymore. Zach Ward joins us. He's a consultant with J.D. Power and Associates. Tesho Akindele is a development analyst with Camp North End. And Seth LaJeunesse is a senior research associate with the UNC Highway Safety Research Center. Seth, if you're riding high in one of these big honking SUVs or with these big pickup trucks, oversized pickup trucks, does your behavior, do we have any statistics on this? Does your behavior as a driver change? Do those drivers who do feel safer tend to be more aggressive or take more risks, or are they just normal people, or are they kings of the road?
I'd say the vast majority, Mike, of drivers driving SUVs or any vehicle really are probably normal drivers. Certainly, some members of the population are going to be taking more risks, maybe be more impulsive out there. I will say that over time, and I think Zach has mentioned this earlier as well, the cars have improved from the sort of user perspective in a number of ways, and one of which is that you receive less what we often call as haptic feedback, or feel the vibrations of older vehicles, right? You knew when you were achieving higher speeds, in that old station wagon. But today, you can achieve really elevated speeds and feel virtually nothing. It can be quite smooth. This can, of course, feed back to say, you're not going that fast. At least you don't think, right? If you're not really keeping your eye on the speedometer. We see a lot of that. If there isn't in naturalistic studies where which observe people as they're actually driving, in vehicles where there isn't a lot of this haptic feedback, there's not a lot of checking of how fast they're going, not as much, if you will. So I think there is this sense that I'm not actually going that fast. I'm being responsible. I don't feel like I'm going that fast. And the environment here, usually the roadway is quite large enough that sort of welcomes higher speeds as well. So it's sort of a combined influence that feeds back to people that's saying, going fast is really not that big of a problem. You can, in fact, feel safe doing that, when in fact, it might not be safe.
Yeah, particularly for the people around you. I want to talk about romance for a second. We're talking about cars. Let's talk about romance. Zach, America's relationship with the automobile has been described as romantic. And I think it explains all those big finned cars in the 1950s, all the chrome. We just fell in love. It explains why some people have to drive a new car every couple of years. It's a thing. Other countries view their cars as transportation, not as a status symbol and not as a love affair. Can you explain the romance?
Mike, that's a difficult one to field. I certainly can't comment on other markets as I'm focused on the United States, but I would absolutely say that there is an emotional resonance of the vehicle. It is so tied to the rugged individualism of the American persona. We see in survey feedback that vehicles that really tickle the consumer in terms of design or powertrain rate very highly and resonate even more so with consumers. And if you look at statistics about just the sheer number of hours that Americans spend on the road versus those in other countries, I think maybe this emotional resonance or connection with the vehicle makes sense in that context.
I think Tesha wants to chime in on this. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Americans love cars, but a lot of that is just a response to the built environment here in the US. We have cities that are newer than European cities and were built literally around the idea of a car, that were built and made possible by cars. So in Europe, you have more dense cities with more public transportation. There's less opportunities for cars, so people just don't grow up with that being part of their culture. Over here, you have much bigger sprawling cities. So like even if you say compare Charlotte to New York, the love affair of Charlotte versus people love cars here more than they do in New York, but it makes sense because that's the way our cities are built. So I think one thing we can do to kind of change that perception is to give people the opportunity to live closer into the city in more dense environments where you don't have to rely on cars as much. Here in Charlotte, we have neighborhoods like Noda, Dilworth, Plaza Midwood, et cetera, that are walkable to the grocery store, to the train, to your school. We need more neighborhoods like that. Not everybody wants to live in a place like that, but I think more people do than have the opportunity. We should zone for that, and we should encourage developers to kind of provide that product so we can, let more people choose how they want to live.
Seth.
Mike, I want to follow up with what Tesha was saying. I agree. There's two points. The National Association of Realtors every other year puts out a survey and asks people about how they want to live, what they want from their communities, what they want from their, and most people want to live in a walkable community. In fact, especially younger folks, they're willing to trade off a large yard and having to drive places for a smaller yard and being able to walk places. That's the majority. This idea of the love affair, the other point is the idea of a love affair is actually pinned to a specific incident in our history. It's 1991 NBC TV documentary featuring none other than Groucho Marx, who actually made that comment. He coined that phrase, America's love affair with the vehicle. That's where this idea comes from. It was sort of an idea implanted. It may have reflected reality at the time. I don't know. But this actually was a sort of a manufactured concept,
Yeah.
back in
Well,
that day.
so was suburbia, and I remember because I'm old enough to remember. When I Love Lucy moved from New York City with Fred Nethel, they moved to the suburbs and they all got in the car and they drove. There were episodes about them driving across the bridge into, I guess, suburban New York and living in a neighborhood. We built the whole country around that, and we built it around the interstate highway system, which I don't know which came first, the highway system to allow cars to grow, or we had these cars, we wanted to drive them. But it kind of works in tandem. Back in the day, people were looking for the most stylish car they could get their hands on. The tail fins that I alluded to, the lighting effects in some of these cars, the paint colors, the curves that they build into the sheet metal to make these cars attractive. What attracts buyers today, Zach? Because a lot of these things just look like great big boxes on four wheels. And I'm wondering what makes people willing to encumber themselves for 60 or 72 months worth of payments? What makes them fall in love with these cars?
Mike, that's an excellent question. And I think if you look at the survey results, exterior and interior design, as well as powertrain responsiveness, the technology in the vehicle all still bubble to the top of survey returns. I think potentially what you're seeing is a new definition of what style means to the consumer. Certainly back in the day with the lack of safety regulations, there was a lot more leeway with which a manufacturer could design a vehicle. The fins back in the day would certainly never meet pass muster with pedestrian safety regulations these days. Also, you see manufacturers try to streamline their production methods as well, use parts throughout their lineup, interchangeable between all of their vehicles, standardize their platforms to use between even vehicles within different classes. It's basically just a skateboard on top of which the passenger compartment sits. Mm-hmm. So you see a lot more uniformity throughout the industry. However, design still plays a really crucial role in the mind of the consumer, even if vehicles aren't as differentiated and not changing as revolutionarily every year. Now we see standardized product life cycles of probably 5 years with a mid-cycle refresh taking place somewhere in between there. So I hopefully that gets a bit to your question.
Seth, one of the things that I talked about at the very beginning of this is that a lot of drivers today feel safer. They feel that their families are safer in these larger vehicles. And as I said, that may be true for the people in the vehicles, but not necessarily for those around the vehicles in smaller cars or walking. So the question, I guess, is, are they really safer, or is it just a perception?
That's a great question again, Mike. For the most part, on average, yes, they are safer. Car occupants have been increasingly getting safer the last probably 3 or 4 decades. That's where most of our safety gains have actually accrued, is for the car occupants. And a lot of these larger vehicles do protect the occupants quite well, especially since the standards, think of side impact airbags and frontal airbags are now standard, things that didn't used to be in the past. The shift has really been to people operating outside the vehicle. So we've been talking about pedestrians, people riding bikes, scooters. These are people that are especially vulnerable now, increasingly so, especially with the metastasizing of the size of vehicles. I think Tesho mentioned sort of the hood height, that being a really key factor in crash dynamics. You know, someone can be drug under a vehicle if they're struck with a hood height that is substantial. So these are concerns for all road users out there. And it's good to see that there is sort of increasing interest in regulating some of these factors on the vehicles.
Tesho, the city of Charlotte joined in a global effort to reduce traffic fatalities to zero by the year 2030. It's called Vision Zero. It's happening around the world, but we're one of the cities in the United States that has adopted this as a goal. But it's something that is apparently easier to achieve in other places, except for here, except for Ireland, Switzerland, and the United States traffic fatalities have been declining as much as 27% in those other places over the in recent years. But we in the United States lead the way in traffic fatality increases. And in just the last year here in Charlotte, there have been 73 fatalities involving traffic. Do we know what kinds of vehicles have been involved in the in those 73 fatalities in Charlotte, and what role the adoption of larger vehicles may have played or may not have played in those accidents?
Honestly, I'm not sure specifically about those vehicles. I think, like you said, Ryan Pitkin, Queen City Nerve, I think they're the ones reporting on that. So people should definitely go read their reports. But like you said, we adopted Vision Zero plan, I think, in 2018. And an audit came out. How has Charlotte been progressing towards those goals? The audit found that there's nobody in the city of Charlotte in charge of this Vision Zero program. So they like said, we're going to do Vision Zero. We want no traffic deaths by 2030. And nobody is like actually in charge of implementing that. I think number one, that's a huge mistake. Number two is we had 71 traffic deaths, or 73, sorry, you said, in the past year. We should treat those as serious incidents and do full investigations. Like, I think a lot of times traffic deaths are treated as, oh, it was a mistake, it was driver error, which is often true. I'm not saying that anybody is necessarily being malicious or something, but is it a problem with the roadways that we can fix? Is it a problem with the sidewalks or whatever? We should treat these and do full investigations into what is causing these deaths, because that's 73 lives lost. I think they deserve, you know, a full investigation to that. And if I could just say one more point, it's easier to change. For example, if you find there's a lot of crashes happening on certain roads, we can change the design of those roads. Like, those roads are probably designed wrong more so than drivers are behaving bad. We can change the design of those roads, and it's easier when CDOT, the Charlotte Department of Transportation, controls those roads than when NCDOT controls those roads. So we should look to take over control of some of our roads, especially in urban areas when we can.
Do we have the money to do that? I mean, the state, I don't think, puts a lot of money into maintaining some of these roads, even though they control them. Do we have the money to take them over? And can we take them over?
I mean, if we're going to prioritize Vision Zero, I think that has to be part of it, especially if you see opportunities to take over certain roads. That makes complete sense to me.
Because according to the Charlotte Observer, the city of Charlotte has already spent $21.1 million on Vision Zero and tens of millions of more dollars on sidewalks and bicycle and pedestrian programs since 2019. But there has not been any significant decrease in crashes or deaths or serious injuries. Was the goal, this Vision Zero goal, of reducing all fatalities to zero by 2030, almost about five years from now, was that ever realistic?
I don't know about zero being realistic by 2030, but it's realistic in the United States. For example, Hoboken is a city in New Jersey that hasn't had a traffic death in 10 years or something like that. So it's realistic. It's been achieved within the U.S., and I think like one way to do that is just be more serious about studying what is happening at each of these traffic deaths, instead of assuming each of them are just kind of a random one-off mistake. What happened? What can we learn? What can we fix with the roadway design to make sure it doesn't happen again?
In this country, cars are a statement. They're a statement about how successful you are, about who you are, what your goals and your ideals and your values are. It tells people stuff. So do you believe, Zach, that that is still true, that still motivates people to gravitate toward one model of a car or another? What does driving a three-row SUV or a truck that you don't use for farming do for your image?
I'll answer it at the highest level, which is yes, absolutely. Vehicles still make a statement about their buyer, their driver. Purchasers are very cognizant of this as well. And I do think, to get to the meat of your question, that could be a driving factor behind the proliferation of SUVs. There are many other things, as I said before, it's no monolithic factor, but that could certainly be a contributing factor.
Seth, there are a lot of policy changes that could be made that would even the equation out a little bit and put money where it's needed, like in improving roads and enlarging parking spaces. And we could enact weight based taxes on cars if we really wanted to ensure less of a car bloat. But consumers who already own these vehicles do not want to be penalized now. Are we even wasting our breath? And I have 30 seconds. Are we wasting our breath talking about it?
I don't think so, Mike. I think, you know, road trauma, as we like to call it, is a serious public health problem, entirely preventable, as other countries have shown us. It's really a matter of fomenting a sort of pro-regulatory culture and having more those in power affect change in it.
I think we're about to enter a deregulatory culture, to be honest with you, over the next 4 years. We'll see how that goes. Seth Lajeunesse is a senior research associate with UNC's Highway Safety Research Center, Zach Ward with J.D. Power, and Tesho Akindele, a development analyst with Camp North End. Thank you all.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.